Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 30th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Good morning. This week's cover story is entitled Reinventing House Calls by Jason DeBrun. With healthcare facilities staring at penalties, the business of care is changing. Some days, Dr. Michael Watson feels like he is practicing a type of medicine long forgotten. He makes many house calls, seeing patients in their homes instead of requiring patients to meet him in an office. Healthcare systems now face penalties from the federal government if too many patients return to the hospital within 30 days of a discharge. Those penalties have caused hospital leaders to put a lot of effort in extending the care they provide outside the hospital campus, even into the patient's home. Services provided by Watson, a managing partner for Paired Health Physician Group in Raleigh, are an example of the outside-the-box thinking that hospital executives hope can reduce penalties as well as overall health care cost. By making house calls, physicians can keep patients healthier in their homes and prevent them from returning to the hospital. The practice will mean a little extra investment on the front end, but it could result in better, more holistic care, especially for elderly patients. Readmissions have been a big focus, says Roy Temke, Director of Case Management at Rex Healthcare, part of the UNC healthcare system. Fundamentally, hospitals across America have to change the way they think about care, he says. For decades, hospitals set themselves up to treat episodes of care. Patients would come into the hospital, doctors would treat patients, and patients would leave the hospital. That was essentially it. The same patient could come back in 2 days, and the hospital would treat those patients the same way and again discharge them without much thought to post-discharge care. Now, because of a major provision in the Affordable Care Act, hospitals will face a reduction of up to 2% of Medicare reimbursements if patients they discharge are admitted to any hospital within the first 30 days. This has led to hospitals thinking about how care more holistically and making sure they follow up with patients, especially those at a high risk of returning to the hospital. It caused some grumbling among hospitals early on, but most executives in the Triangle now recognize the potential to improve care and are working within the new system, even if somewhat begrudgingly. Temke acknowledges that the penalty reward system from Medicare has definitely helped many of these programs along. I think it's great work, and it's a long time overdue, he says. For now, WickMed Health and Hospitals is the only area hospital to partner with Dr. Watson and Paired Health, a company whose overarching goal is to reinvent house calls, says company president Sean Harrison. This service is available for referred patients who don't have established primary care or those who have difficulty getting to the doctor's office because they have multiple conditions or are particularly frail. We extend that envelope of care, says Harrison. We pick up that care baton, if you will. In short, Paired Health works as a short-term provider of primary care during the 30 days after discharge. A team of physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants make house calls, helping at-risk parents, often the elderly, recover without needing to return to the hospital. The need for transitional care is on the rise to help keep the aging population healthy and independent and to avoid unnecessary hospital readmissions, says Deb Lowry. The better a patient's care is managed for the next 30 days, the less likely he or she will need a return trip to the hospital. WakeMed takes pride in providing exceptional care, and we know that responsibility does not end after a patient has been discharged from the hospital. Harrison says that a house call is an admittedly inefficient way of providing care. However, He points out that because 15% of patients drive roughly 75% of cost, figures accepted widely throughout the American healthcare system, it makes sense to spend a little extra time and money on that 15%. As for house calls, Harrison likes to say he's going back to the future because they used to be commonplace. For now, Paired Health treats only WakeMed patients, but Harrison says he wants to form similar partnerships with hospitals in the Triangle and throughout the state. On average, Paired Health makes 100 calls per month. While other area hospitals don't have such a partnership, they are thinking just as carefully about reducing readmissions, particularly for high-risk patients like those with heart failure or heart attack, says Janet Hadar, Vice President of Professional and Support Services at UNC Hospitals. The hospital is forming teams to more specifically focus on educating patients before discharge. It won't mean any new hires, at least not yet, but a restructuring of how current staff interact with a patient, especially in the final hours of a hospital stay. Hospital administrators are going to develop ways of studying what works best. We still need to learn more about the best approaches to be really effective, says Dr. Mike Pignoni, professor of medicine and chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine at UNC School of Medicine. Pignoni says medical schools must train doctors to think about reducing admissions. That hasn't been emphasized as much, though there is a lot of retraining to teach the right set of skills, he says. One of our goals is to teach all of our students about improvement techniques. A step that sounds simple but could have a major positive effect is helping patients properly take their medication. Medication mismanagement is a very common reason that patients come back to the hospital, Hadar says. To help patients understand their medications better, hospital staff are instructed to make sure patients really understand the medicines they've prescribed and to ask patients if they will have difficulty obtaining prescriptions or paying for refills. Medication non-adherence adds an estimated $290 billion to overall health care spending annually, according to National Community Pharmacists Association. There are consequences, both economic and in terms of quality care, he says. Taking the right drug appropriately is better for the patient and it saves money, says Fred Eckel, interim executive director of the North Carolina Association of Pharmacists. Next up, Occam hopes to capitalize on growth strategy. Targeted acquisitions could position company for its own sweet deal in a couple of years. This article is by Lauren K. Onisorge. Contract research organizations are shopping for deals. It's a developing trend in the Triangle, with Quintiles' acquisition of Morrisville-based Novella Clinical serving as the latest example. And one man eyeing the price tags is Jim Baker, CEO of Occam. With Novella in Quintiles' clutches, Occam says he stands as the largest privately held oncology-focused firm. But it might not be private for long. Baker says the shopping spree proves the market for CROs is hot, and Occam is assessing its options. Occam, which started as ASG Incorporated nearly 30 years ago, began as a sourcing business, working with large pharma companies to hire and outsource data management and other clinical operations personnel, and then gradually started performing clinical services for clients. In 2009, ASG changed its business model, purchasing Cary-based Occam Development Group in an all-stock deal and changing its name to Occam. The buy meant the creation of two divisions, Occam's traditional sourcing firm, Occam Source, and a new clinical division. Add in Edinburgh-based Nexus Oncology, acquired in 2012, and Occam continued to grow. Now, with about 300 employees, 100 in Research Triangle Park, Occam is pulling in about $50 million in annual revenue. The company is even prepping a move from its current location on Regency Parkway to a 19,700-square-foot office in Cary's Center Green 2 building, confirms spokesperson Tim Pittman. I think we're in a pretty good position going forward, Baker says. Bill Donovan, Occam president, agrees, adding that it's an exciting time and market to be Occam. But Occam's future, Baker says, rests in its ability to back up strategies with growth. That's why he's embarking on a bullish acquisition mission. Existing investors, he says, have the capital for additional acquisitions. We are looking to continue to round out our oncology CRO offerings in respect to patient enrollment feasibility, he says, and he wants to do it by expanding across the globe. On the Occam Source side, Occam is looking to acquire as well, specifically targeting Europe. On the Source side, we're targeting Europe because the Occam Source business does about half of our revenue, and it's exclusively in the U.S., he says. By adding additional facilities in Europe, Occam can mimic with Source what it's already doing with its new Edinburgh office and clinical. The business is also looking at opportunities in Asia. Asian and Eastern European reaches could make Occam global, Donovan says. On the clinical side, the company is looking for acquisition targets with hefty client lists. The growth isn't just about bulk, however, it's about the future for Occam and its investors. Baker hopes eventually to be on the other side of a big deal. I would say that our horizon is 18 to 24 months, and it would be capitalization through private equity and or strategic partner purchase, he says. But an IPO isn't out of the question. Occam currently has locations in Cary, San Antonio, Grays Lake, Illinois, the UK, France, Belgium, Canada, Hungary, Sweden, Switzerland, Germany, and Spain. An acquisition doesn't just add to the footprint. Deals also add to the bottom line. Take the Quintiles Novella deal. Baird equity research analyst Eric Coldwell writes in a research note that Novella will mean $150 million in revenue this year. Continuing deeper inside this week's Triangle Business Journal, Amanda Hoyle writes for the commercial and residential real estate area. Her column this week is entitled, Look What's Coming to Retail Centers. Three more shops from the soon-to-be-demolished University Square complex on Franklin Street and Chapel Hill are making the move over to University Mall on the east side of town. Fine Feathers, Peacock Alley, and Kidzu Children's Museum will be relocating to the University Mall this fall in time to be open for the holiday shopping season. University Square is slated to be torn down in early 2014 to make way for a bigger mixed-use development project called 123 West Franklin. In Town Square, Raleigh, Best Buy is rethinking its big-box strategy for its store on Capitol Boulevard in North Raleigh. Sources say Best Buy is negotiating a deal to move from the Triangle Plaza Shopping Center, where it has been in operation since 2003, to a smaller retail space at the Town Square Shopping Center about a mile away. The Town Square space was vacated by the Room Store Furniture Showroom in 2012. In Park West Village of Morrisville, the Carter's Children's Wear retailer has signed a lease to open a second non-outlet store location in the Triangle at the Park West Village Retail Power Center in a 4,059-square-foot space near TJ Maxx. The Morrisville store is expected to open in November. Carter's plans to also keep its store in the Briar Creek Commons Shopping Center in Raleigh, which replaced the store that closed a while back at the Morrisville Outlet Mall. North Point in Durham, the owners of the North Point Shopping Center in Durham have carved up the former 18,000-square-foot World Market space to make room for several new fashion retailers. Rue 21 has opened in a 5,000-square-foot space, and Cato has moved into 4,000 square feet, says retail representative President Brian Grabowski, leaving only a 7,300-square-foot vacancy between Rue 21 and Ross Dress for less. Celebration at Six Forks in Raleigh, a new restaurant called LQ Restaurant, has opened at the Celebration at Six Forks Shopping Center at the intersection of Six Forks and Sawmill Roads in North Raleigh. Renaissance Village, Durham, North Carolina native and celebrated Raleigh restaurateur, Jason Smith is stepping out of his Inside the Beltline comfort zone and will be opening a farm-to-fork restaurant called Harvest 18 at the Renaissance Village Shopping Center in Durham. Smith also owns the popular 18 Seaboard restaurant at Seaboard Station in downtown Raleigh, and the Cantina 18 restaurant in Cameron Village Shopping Center in Raleigh. Harrison Point in Cary. A new child drop-off facility and a new German-style restaurant will be opening soon at the Harrison Point Shopping Center in Cary. Giggles Drop-In Child Care, a Wilmington-based company that offers hourly child care services, is opening its first franchise location in Cary, taking a 4,200-square-foot space. German Grill, a new full-service German restaurant that will also have several German beers on tap, will be taking a 4,000-square-foot space. German Grill is expected to open in the next 3 to 4 months. Continuing on in real estate, 751 South project is ready to move forward. The developers of the proposed 751 South real estate project in South Durham are ready to put the project's controversial past behind them and move forward with the first phase. Southern Durham Development has hired NAI Carolantic Realty of Raleigh to market to potential builders the 751 South land located off NC 751 between Stagecoach Road and the Chatham County line. The 167-acre project had been in regulatory limbo after Durham city leaders rejected the developer's request to annex the land into the city limits and to provide water and sewer services to the site. However, the new state legislation forces the city to comply with most of the requests made by Southern Durham. As proposed, 751 South will include as much as 600,000 square feet of office and commercial space, and as many as 1,300 residences. Chapel Hill has become quite the giver. Sales tax receipts collected in nearly all the communities surrounding the Orange County town show that way more dollars are being spent outside of Orange County than are coming in. While Chapel Hill may rank as the wealthiest county in the state when it comes to per capita income, nearly all of its neighbors, particularly in Alamance County, take a higher percentage in sales tax revenue. Most of Chapel Hill's retail gap, according to the data collected for the Chapel Hill Carrboro Chamber of Commerce's 2013 State of the Community Report, is among general merchandise stores, motor vehicle and parts dealers, and food and beverage stores. The only area in retail where Chapel Hill has a surplus is in health and personal care stores like CVS and Walgreens. Next up, Jason DeBruin. Jason covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business. And this week is the Triangle Business Journal's preview of the 2013 ACC Triangle Football. Sure, it's only kickoff weekend and a long way to go before the championship game, but it's not too early to buy tickets. Tickets for the 2013 Atlantic Coast Conference Football Championship game are now on sale. Prices are $25 and $40 for upper level, $70 and $90 for lower level, and $150 and $175 for club level. The game, which is in its ninth year under the current format, will have a 7:45 or 8 p.m. kickoff on December 7th in Charlotte's Bank of America Stadium. That's where the Carolina Panthers play home games. Also, it's home to the Belk Bowl. The winner earns the ACC bid to play in the Discover Orange Bowl, if not selected for the BCS National Championship game. It's an exciting time in the ACC as we kick off the 2013 season and begin to watch the 14 football programs compete for a spot in this year's Dr. Pepper ACC Football Championship game, says ACC Commissioner John Swofford. As we look ahead to December 7th, we appreciate the support of the City of Charlotte and look forward to the event's continued growth. The game has been sold out in 2 of its 3 years in Charlotte, and as someone who has been to a few games there, I can tell you it's usually a pretty good time, even if it's raining. Next up, Lauren Onisorge. Lauren covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. The North Carolina CEO Forum, where top leaders can and do speak their minds. A 2013 CEO Forum brought suited leaders to Northridge Country Club for a series of high-profile introductions and soundbites. Governor Pat McCrory, quote, "All of us in this room need to go on a recruitment binge like we're going after basketball players." General Colin Powell, quote, "So many people don't understand that leadership is always about trust between two people." John Chambers, quote, "We don't compete against competitors. We compete against market transitions." Paul Newton, quote, "How can we move quickly when we are so highly regulated? We are constrained by a regulatory paradigm. It's a real challenge." Deidre Connolly, quote, "Change is hard. The usual order is upset, feathers ruffled, and you may not win at any popularity contest." Brad Wilson, quote, "It rocked that boat. It stirred the pot. It scared people. The Affordable Care Act made many of us hit the accelerator." Ronald DeLang, quote, "86% of customers will pay more if they have a better user experience." And Tom Pike, quote, "If you know me, you know I am all about growth. I think it's crucial if we continue to grow that we are leaders in innovations." What follows next is a perspective by Paul Newton. The secret in running a successful company? Culture. That's according to Paul Newton, state president for Duke University. He says it only takes one time making fun of an employee's comments during a staff meeting to sabotage your culture. It's going to chill the environment for every other employee in your group, he says. Innovation is going to die and you are going to be flying solo. And that's not how a CEO should operate, no matter the sector, he says. We cannot do it alone, he says. There are no lone ranger leaders. The advantage, he says, isn't in the direct threats. Everyone can see those. By having an environment that encourages communications, leaders can see the indirect threats. How? By having employees who are comfortable enough to tell you exactly what's going on. You have to have that kind of culture, he says. And John Chambers, CEO of Cisco Systems, is a numbers guy. Prior to receiving a standing ovation, the keynote speaker and leader of a networking giant that employs 5,500 people in Research Triangle Park threw numbers to the C-level crowd. $500 billion, the number of connected devices he predicts will emerge over the next decade. $14 trillion, the profit that will result for private companies alone. And from this week's In Case You Missed It column in the Triangle Business Journal, the Jimmy V Celebrity Golf Classic rolls out the red carpet. Imagine, if you will, a weekend loaded with celebrities that included a fashion show and a golf outing. Add on top of that a special night full of hope and inspiration. The 20th anniversary Jimmy V Celebrity Golf Classic delivered it all. The Jimmy V Foundation raises money for cancer research and embodies the spirit and energy of the late North Carolina State University basketball coach Jim Valvano. Every penny raised from the foundation goes towards the ongoing fight against cancer. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. By Todd Cohen. West Raleigh Baseball Association boosts kids and charities. 80 people, mainly children, helped raise more than $30,000 last May to support cancer programs and research by shaving their heads. The event for the Versus Cancer Foundation was sponsored by the West Raleigh Baseball Association, a nonprofit spun off in the early 1990s from the West Raleigh Exchange Club. Growing out of a youth baseball league that the club established in 1958 to help advance its mission of providing service to family, community, and country, the association serves over 800 children ages 4 to 14 through a baseball program each spring and fall. The association operates with an annual budget of roughly $300,000, a full-time operations director and a part-time bookkeeper, and nearly 100 volunteers. All revenue comes from the registration fees and raffles. All games are held on three fields at Exchange Club Park in West Raleigh. The association pays rent to the Exchange Club to use those fields for games and practices. It also pays rent to the City of Raleigh and the Town of Cary to use their fields for practices. The association also supports charitable causes through volunteering and donations from dollars it raises at special events, says Gary Federer, who is president of the association and general counsel at Lulu Press, a self-publishing company in Raleigh. For many years, the association raised nearly $10,000, mainly in in-kind support, to collect and prepare food for charities. But this year, the group decided to step up its fundraising. It teamed up with the Raleigh-based Versus Cancer Foundation, created by Chase Jones, who, as a freshman member of a varsity baseball team at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, was diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer. The best part, Federer says, was that the children returned to school after the event and had to explain why their heads were shaved. It started influencing teachers and friends and family, creating more awareness for kids with cancer, he says. The foundation has divided the funds the association raised between the Duke Children's Hospital, which will use the funds to buy iPads and computer games to improve the quality of life for kids undergoing chemotherapy, and national research efforts. In addition to its event for the Versus Cancer Foundation, the association has worked for about 10 years with the Exchange Club to deliver meals to the Pediatric Bone Marrow Transplant Unit at the Duke Comprehensive Cancer Center. One or two Sundays a month, 12 families from the association each create a large dish and bring it to the Exchange Club, with club members then delivering the dishes for use by family members staying with their children who are patients in the transplant unit. The association also holds two food drives a year to benefit urban ministries of Wake County. This spring, its drive generated 3,000 pounds of food worth over $6,000. As an organization, we want to be able to give back to the community, Federer says. We want our kids to learn more about life through baseball as well as giving to others. Next up, high-risk patients skew the returns. Since Medicaid patients are particularly susceptible to readmissions, it makes sense to target their follow-ups. By Jason DeBrune. As hospitals think about ways to reduce their cost and readmissions, they must think hard about how best to treat Medicaid patients. North Carolina lawmakers decided not to expand the program this year, and the public health care insurance program is available largely only to women and children or those with disabilities. Still, it's on pace to pay out between $12 billion and $13 billion in medical bills in North Carolina this year, with the federal government paying about two-thirds and the state picking up one-third of that total. Medicare is a larger federal program that is available only to those 65 and older and run completely at the federal level. The government sets prices for both Medicare and Medicaid. They are not negotiated as with private insurers. For Medicaid, the government sets its reimbursement basically at the hospital's cost. Hospital executives say Medicaid patients too often don't regularly see a primary care physician and therefore develop issues due to high blood pressure or other diseases that develop over time. Because they aren't caught early, the Medicaid population is more likely to go on to an emergency room when a major medical event occurs. Because treating patients in emergency care is so much more expensive, this drives up overall cost, say many healthcare experts. In North Carolina, a nonprofit called Community Care of North Carolina has tried to better manage that segment of the population. In addition to some medical care, CCNC works to make sure Medicaid patients are properly taking their medicines or give them a ride to the doctor's office for a follow-up visit if they don't have transportation. In a recent study by CCNC that was published in Health Affairs, an academic medical journal, Annette Dubard and her team say that for every six assessments performed by CCNC, the group reduces one hospital readmission, something that has an average cost of $6,200 in this population. An earlier study by actuarial firm Milliman Incorporated found that CCNC saved the system more than $1 billion from 2007 through 2010, and their work has even garnered some national attention. CCNC, too, is thinking more about reducing hospital readmissions. Analysts there have refined their methodologies around flagging patients who are most likely to benefit from the transition of care. Now, when its system receives a real-time notification of a high-risk Medicaid patient going to a hospital, the group routes a care manager who many times will establish contact before the patient is even discharged. That has really helped our efficiencies, Dubard says. There are now 57 hospitals that participate in real-time notifications that CCNC can link up to its risk factor algorithms, enabling them to more effectively target those patients at the highest risk of returning to the hospital. CCNC by the numbers. 1.3 million enrolled beneficiaries. 305,000 are aged, blind, and disabled. 5,000 are participating physicians, and 1,600 are medical homes. And it happens in 100 of the North Carolina counties of operation. Next up, retail giant Staples buys Carey's Lone Source by Lauren Onisores. Carey-based Lone Source Incorporated has been sold to office supply retailer Staples in what insiders are calling a very good deal. Financial details were not disclosed, but John Fenibrescu Jr., the managing director at Charlotte-based Fenibrescu & Company, which brokered the deal, says the sale happened Monday. Lone Source had been exploring strategic alternatives when Staples emerged as the best opportunity, he said. Staples, which has faced increased market pressure from the likes of Amazon, grabs Lone Source's customer portfolio as well as its e-procurement platform. Lone Source, which opened its doors in Cary in 2000, is headed by CEO Brad King, who confirmed the deal to Triangle Business Journal. King would not make any additional comments. The company ranked number 16 on TBJ's annual list of the fastest-growing Triangle companies in 2011. It claimed 45 local employees, with 200 total at its offices in Cary, Greensboro, Atlanta, Memphis, and Nashville at the time. In that same year, the company bought another office supply company, Office Options, which has locations in Fuquay Varina, Holly Springs, Anger, and Lillington. In 2010, the company had about $63 million in revenue. Staples' total company sales for 2012 was $6.57 billion. Executives at Staples were not available to comment on the acquisition. Lone Source made headlines earlier this year when it ended up having to pay $1.3 million to its primary supplier, United Stationers Supply. Lone Source sued USS in 2011, alleging that it had unilaterally raised paper prices despite an existing contract. United Stationers countersued and won, alleging Lone Source had violated their contract. What follows next is an in-depth special report that provides an up-to-the-minute look at the new developments that will forever change our capital city, the City of Medicine, and the area known as Blue Heaven. A note from the Triangle Business Journal editor. How often have you driven around the Triangle and found yourself asking, "What's going on here?" or "Who is going into that new building?" Well, we will try to answer some of those questions in this growth special report that looks at the five hottest areas in the Triangle, broken down by geographical boundaries. From office buildings to warehouse to retail centers, it's all happening here right in front of our eyes as investors pour in hundreds of millions of dollars to develop our communities. Spearheaded by our real estate reporter, Amanda Jones Hoyle, this section delves into the recently completed projects and upcoming major projects in these five focus areas. In the following pages, you will hear about the five largest employers in these regions. But with growth comes planning. Do we have the necessary infrastructure in place to accommodate this growth? What about the rules and regulations imposed by the local municipalities and their potential impact on businesses, individuals, and families? That is for you to decide. Concerning actions needed to support this growth, we hope you use this special report as a primer as we connect communities and start a conversation about our current and future needs for a healthy economy. Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. Inside the Beltline, Raleigh Welcomes Innovators by Lauren K. Onisorge. Downtown Raleigh has been inching its way towards top tech clout, first with Red Hat, then with companies such as Citrix and Ipreo. But lately, the tech entrepreneurship community has decided it's tired of inching. A set of new entrepreneurial endeavors could give Raleigh a big boost in innovation, making Raleigh not just a place for larger tech companies to settle, but also for an ideal place for that technology to be born. A theory is budding companies recruited to downtown Raleigh will be so excited by the communal entrepreneurial spirit that they'll stay in the city of Oaks. If just one of the companies happens to be next to Red Hat, it'll be more than worth the gamble. HQ Raleigh, an entrepreneurial company, co-working space, hosting such companies as WedPix, isn't even a year old and is already expanding. According to Executive Director Jason Wyden, 45 companies are working in the space and there's a waiting list. Wyden is also spearheading something called Think House, where even more entrepreneurs can participate in a new living, learning community downtown. And Adam Klein, Chief Strategist for Durham entrepreneurial staple American Underground, has announced that effort is expanding into downtown Raleigh as well. We want the Triangle to be one of the top five entrepreneurial regions in the country, and that can't be done without working together, Wyden says. According to Derek Miner, Innovation and Entrepreneurship Manager for the City of Raleigh, the new entrepreneurship options won't have any difficulty finding tenants. He estimates about 300 startups are housed in Raleigh. These are rough numbers, he says. I still seem to uncover new companies fairly regularly. And the budding entrepreneurship community is already being recognized. Raleigh nabbed the number 13 spot for tech startups nationwide in a Kauffman Foundation study. Northern Wake County, Lives of the Rich and Famous by Thompson Wall. With the highest concentration of $750,000 plus homes in the Triangle area, Northern Wake is well known for its luxury home market. Just ask the numerous professional ice hockey and baseball players, Triangle executives, and former Pittsburgh Steelers coach Bill Cowher what they think of the area's highest-priced housing developments like the Barony or Hossentree. Even former basketball star Michael Jordan can't resist owning property in Northern Wake County. Luxury communities like Chatsworth Overlook, the Registry, and Wakefield Plantation, as well as the Bailey Farms and the Linville Farms, gated communities, are all popular choices for several current and retired Canes players, including Ron Francis, Tim Gleason, and brothers Jordan and Eric Stahl. According to Linda Kraft, CEO of Linda Kraft and Team Realtors in Raleigh, and the president of the Luxury Home Marketing Group, the demand for luxury housing is steadily growing. Between 125 and 150 new luxury houses are expected to sell this year alone, up from the market's low in 2011 when only 84 luxury houses were sold. The units sold in the upper end dropped significantly in 2007 to 2011, but the market is returning now, Linda Kraft said. Residents are drawn to the Falls Lake watershed as well as the area's close proximity to PNC Arena, Research Triangle Park, and the Raleigh-Durham Airport. But according to Kraft, the biggest driver is the prime choice in executive housing, where estate-sized homes often sit on 1 or 2 acres of prime Falls Lake property. Midtown. Activity surges near retail hubs by Thompson Wall. Midtown Raleigh has grown to become one of the most heavily saturated areas in the Triangle for retail, residential, and office space over the past 50 years, thanks to a handful of persevering real estate developers and regional visionaries. John Kane Sr., Chairman and CEO of Kane Realty Corporation in Raleigh, is known best for his successful redevelopment of the North Hills Mall property at the intersection of Six Forks Road and the I-440 Beltline in the Midtown Retail Office Residential and Entertainment Powerhouse. It was the first mall between D.C. and Atlanta in the mid-60s, Kane said. It was a thriving mall, but started going downhill after about 30 or 40 years due to lack of direction. We bought it back in 2000 and started recycling that whole area, converting it to a mixed-use midtown environment. Kane says the area now boasts 700 new residential units and has another 650 under construction, along with entitlements for another 1 million square feet of office space, another 500,000 square feet of retail, and another 1,300 residential units projected over the next 10 years. Kane Realty Corporation, North Hills Development Company, has invested nearly $750 million in the development project over the past 10 years, and it expects to have more than $250 million in the new building projects underway before the end of 2013. Slated projects include two apartment communities, Alistair North Hills and Midtown Green, which will add a combined 648 new apartment units to the market. A $1 million park and amphitheater, the Cardinal at North Hills Retirement Community, and construction of the 18-story, 300,000-square-foot Tower 2 office building that Kane wants to begin building in December of this year. The newest project, a 137-room Hyatt House Hotel, opened in July. But North Hills isn't the only city center with a full plate of projects this year. Neil Rudolph, Vice President of Crabtree Valley's malls management company, Plaza Associates, says current construction projects in the Crabtree area may bring up to 1,000 new apartment units by 2014. "You could immediately throw a rock to each one of them from our site," Rudolph said. A Charlotte developer, for example, has started work on the proposed Crabtree Village mixed-use project atop Kids Hill, just off Blue Ridge Road, where the home of former Raleigh politician Kid Brewer once stood. Brewer sold the land that would become Crabtree Valley Mall. The 24-acre property is slated to have up to 525 apartments and condo units, a 200-room hotel, up to 250,000 square feet of office space, and up to 60,000 square feet of retail space when completed. The first phase is a $35 million building with 293 apartments that should be ready for move-in by May of 2014. A Houston real estate company also owns a 12-acre site that overlooks the mall off Crabtree Valley Avenue that is slated for new development after the former Kids Hill Plaza property was torn down several years ago. A third major project, Crabtree North, which is across from the Crabtree Valley Mall property on the opposite side of Glenwood Avenue, was approved for rezoning earlier this year. Crabtree North's owners want to replace the aging apartment communities on the site with more than 700 new apartment units and 125,000 square feet of retail and restaurant space. Rudolph says the mall currently has about as much square footage as Rex Healthcare, another of this year's most ambitious builders in the Midtown area. Rex opened a new surgery center this year in the new four-story, 98,000-square-foot Raleigh Orthopedic Building on Blue Ridge Road that opened in March, and the hospital system has gained approval to build a $279 million heart and stroke tower, which is expected to open in 3 years. "I think we all feed well off each other," Rudolph says of Rex Healthcare. "We'll often see a lot of people come over for lunch hour. There's very good synergy here." RTP and Expressway. Retail and rooftops pop up along 540. By Thompson Wall. An explosion of retail and residential construction is unfolding in southwest Wake County as developers continue to chomp at the bit for parcels of available land. Along the Triangle Expressway in Apex, Cary, and Morrisville, new housing starts this year are up 24%, healthy but slower than the overall marketing pace, according to Jay Colvin, Director for Metro Studies Triangle Region. "It's not because people don't want to live there, it's because there isn't enough room," Colvin says. Colvin notes this area recovered quickly from the economic downturn and experienced fewer foreclosures than most of the Triangle, which explains why land available for development today is in such short supply and is still in high demand. "That whole area, the RTP feeder zone, is really, really short on lots," Calvin says. Retail spaces are also attracting tenants in droves this year. Park West Village, Morrisville's new $60 million 100-acre mixed-use development, includes a town center, community center, 260 apartment units, and office space, but the project's retail tenants have multiplied past expectations. Another site in West Cary, Kite Realty Group Trust, Incorporated, an Indianapolis-based retail development company, is already attracting tenants like Target and Harris Teeter to its proposed 135,580,000-square-foot retail development Parkside Town Commons that's currently under construction. But below the expressway is where all the action really is. The Holly Springs, Fuquay, Varina areas combined to be one of the Triangle's hottest spots for the new home starts, up by 53% year over year in 2013. And now that the Triangle Expressway is complete between NC 540 at Research Triangle Park and Holly Springs, drivers can commute between the NC 55 bypass at Holly Springs and Research Triangle Park in just 15 minutes. 20 years ago, building anything outside of I-40 would have been unheard of, and now that's where almost all the activity goes on, Colvin says. Holly Springs' wave of new homes developments are also quickly attracting the attention of eager retailers. Holly Springs Town Center, which opened in March, is another of Kite Realty's recent projects. The retail complex opened with 584,110 square feet of retail tenant space that's already being scooped up by big names like Dick's Sporting Goods, Target, Marshalls, Pier 1, Ulta, Petco, and Michaels. Tobacco Road, sharing a unified town and gown vision. This article is also by Thompson Wall. Two of Tobacco Road's most quintessential colleges, Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill, are taking a renewed interest in revitalizing their respective college hometowns and establishing a greater downtown presence. Duke's efforts began 7 years ago with the Making a Difference strategic plan, created after the success of revitalization projects like the American Tobacco Campus and the Durham Performing Arts Center. Duke and Durham are inextricably linked, the plan reads, calling for Duke's leadership in turning downtown Durham into a vibrant hub for culture and recreational activities. In 2005, Duke University owned or leased a mere 70,000 square feet of space in downtown Durham. Duke and its affiliates now encompass more than 950,000 square feet of office and research space, including its recently announced plans to expand into the West Village Powerhouse building at 300 Fuller Street, the 114,600 square foot Carmichael building at 300 Duke Street, and a 52,600 square foot Liggett and Myers Research Building at 710 West Main Street. UNC Chapel Hill has similarly wide-reaching plans to revitalize Chapel Hill's downtown district. Back in 2009, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Foundation purchased Franklin Street's high-profile University Square property, which is slated for a nearly $100 million redevelopment. The goal of the property's redevelopment is provided more high-class office space and apartment spaces than the city's downtown is currently lacking. UNC also plans to build a $65 million, 225,000 square foot research center as the first leg of the 228-acre Carolina North satellite campus project. If successful, the project could pave the way for up to 3 million square feet of space for academics, offices, research, housing, and retail. The university currently has about 60 lease contracts for 413,000 square feet of space scattered throughout the older downtown buildings. Next up, how to build trust in a skeptical world. Today's sales professionals face tough scrutiny by information-loaded customers and prospects. This article is from Colleen Stanley. Ms. Stanley is president of Sales Leadership Incorporated in Denver and author of Emotional Intelligence for Sales Success. We live in the information age, and the bad news is everywhere. There are stories about wealth managers embezzling clients' money, corporate America not looking out for shareholders, and the government overstepping boundaries. Is there more scandal today? No, there's always been scandal. The difference is that access to bad news is easier than ever before. You have TV, the internet, social media, magazines, and more. So how does bad news affect the sales profession? For one thing, prospects are more skeptical. They wonder if you're the real deal or just another professional promise maker. Are you like the person they just heard about on TV or the internet that took advantage of someone? Successful salespeople recognize the dynamics created by the information age. They also realize that building trust and credibility has always been important in closing and retaining business. It's even more important in a cynical, information-loaded world. Here are three ways top sellers build trust and credibility with prospects, customers, and peers. 1. Be the real deal. Most salespeople are genuine and authentic. The problem is, they often don't appear as such during a sales meeting. They think they must say and do something that will impress the prospect. As a result, they look and sound like sales robots, spewing out obvious sales techniques such as, "Wouldn't you agree?" or, "If we could, would you want to move forward?" How about this one? How does that make you feel? It's not the way you talk in your everyday chats, which is why the conversation sounds stilted, canned, and disingenuous. Show up and talk like your prospects. Get rid of the formal language and demeanor. Be the real deal and have real conversations. Let's see if this makes sense for you. Or, if I was you, I'd be more than a little frustrated. Poor preparation for a sales also causes lack of authenticity. A salesperson who hasn't done enough planning will be nervous at the meeting and worried more about the questions he'll be asked than the ones he should ask. When a prospect asks a question or states an objection, the unprepared salesperson stumbles over the answer and appears uncomfortable. This type of response generates even more doubts in the mind of an already doubtful prospect. The real deal salesperson follows the sales playbook. They're diligent about pre-call planning because they have a process. They're not sitting in a meeting wondering what is the next step. They know exactly where they are in the process and thus are free to focus on their prospect, not themselves. They're present and real. They're authentic. Number two, admit mistakes. If you've been in sales long enough, you're going to mess up. And if you aren't messing up, you're probably playing it safe and not showing up. Neither approach helps you hit revenue goals. Admitting mistakes mean you get rid of but language. You know what we're talking about. The company screws up and the salesperson is dealing with the problem. The excuse-driven salesperson says something like, "I am really sorry that we got that delivery to you late, but our suppliers are running behind," or, "I apologize for the incorrect invoicing, but we have this new accounting software." Admit your shortcomings without excuses or blame. Your customers don't want or need to hear the sad story behind the mistake. Take responsibility and fix the problem. When you own up, trust and credibility go up. Number three, follow up and follow through. Do what you say you're going to do. Here's a quick quiz. Review your calendar and look at promises made to colleagues, clients, or prospects. Did you follow through on your commitments? Or did someone have to remind you to do so? Top salespeople are reliable and responsible. Both qualities help build trust because people know they can count on you. When you decide to be a salesperson, you make a commitment to do consistent business development activities. There are CRM tools to help you manage sales activities. Sales managers design a proven roadmap for success, and yet sales managers' number one complaint is inconsistent business development efforts. Think about it. If you're not willing to honor your word to your sales manager, there's a good chance you're not honoring your word in your personal and professional lives. Follow up and follow through. That builds trust and credibility. Be the real deal. Eliminate excuses and honor your word. These three characteristics build trust in a doubtful sales world. This week's guest column is entitled Three Urban Legends of Business Travel Ready to be Destroyed. It's written by Joe Brancatelli, who's a columnist for the Upstart Business Journal, a sister publication with the Triangle Business Journal. Mr. Brancatelli writes, "Business travel is confusing enough without erroneous urban legends complicating our lives on the road. In fact, if you believe the urban legends, we're all lounging on the beach in Maui right now thanks to the free airline tickets and hotel rooms we earned in our frequent travel programs. I can assure you that I'm not in Maui right now. My guess is that if you're reading this, you're not on the beach either. So while we continue our lives as worker bees, here are three other urban legends about business travel that we can dismiss and demolish. Number one, airlines are solidly profitable businesses. Government statistics show that the nation's top 10 largest carriers have managed a cumulative operating profit for each of the last 8 fiscal quarters. That has led some callow analysts to stroke the new urban legend that airlines are now solidly and reliably profitable businesses. 8 profitable quarters for an industry that has lost tens of billions of dollars since 1979's deregulation is no small feat. But the recent string of operating profits is largely built on impossible-to-replicate factors. The big contributor to the bottom line lately has been the lower price of fuel, which accounts for 28.6% of the industry's cost, down from 40% a few years ago. The industry has also denuded itself of employees. Government figures show airlines employed 585,000 workers as of May 2013, down 23% from May of 2001. The remaining rank and filers toil for a fraction of their old wages. In fact, some new flight attendants and pilots at commuter carriers actually qualify for food stamps. Yet even with cheaper energy and fewer lower-paid workers, the industry's first quarter operating profit margin was an anemic 1.3%, hardly the profile of a healthy industry. Number two, in-flight Wi-Fi is an inevitable winner. I've yet to meet a business traveler who doesn't want in-flight Wi-Fi. That's led to the urban legend that in-flight Wi-Fi is a winning business proposition and inevitably reality in our Uber-connected world. The problem with that theory is financial reality. The first in-flight Wi-Fi venture, Boeing Connection, ended with Boeing writing off a $1 billion investment. That's an astonishing number considering Connection was never installed on more than 150 aircraft. The current flag carrier for in-flight Wi-Fi, Gogo, went public on June 21 at $17 a share. It's selling for about $11 now, down 35% in 30 days. Wall Street's lack of faith is rooted in the dreary realities. Gogo has wired nearly 2,000 aircraft since 2008 launch, yet only 5.9% of travelers buy the service on flights where it's available. The company's operating loss for the first half of 2013 more than doubled compared to the first 6 months of last year. And if you say it's early days yet, consider Apple has sold more than 300 million iPhones since that product was introduced about a year ago, before Gogo went live on commercial aircraft. Number three, hotel rates don't change from day to day. It's common knowledge that airline pricing computers and carriers' revenue management departments change fares millions of times each day. That's somehow led to the urban legend that hotel pricing is static and rates don't change between the time you book your room and the time you arrive at the property. Compared to airline pricing, hotel rates are a model of stability. But you're leaving money on the table if you think the lodging industry isn't aggressively yield-managing rates. Even though hotel prices are more transparent than airfares, websites controlled by the major chains display virtually all of their nightly rates on request. They change with stunning frequency. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next week at the same time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.